life is not going to be solved by numbers in a bank account or on your hardware wallet. The issues that really touch us all in our lives, why we're here, what we want to do, how we want to experience love and connection with other people, aren't going to be answered by money.
Fix the money, fix the world is a popular refrain among Bitcoiners. And our guest this week has some big ideas about new social structures that will be made possible once the problem of broken money has truly been solved. Paul Rogers is the author of the recently released book, Money, Love, and Bitcoin, and he's joining us for a conversation about universal law and the spiritual side of Bitcoin. What happens to human civilization when the energetics of money have been reimagined? This is a conversation that I enjoyed tremendously, and I hope you do too. All right. Welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week, we are joined by author of the newly released book, Money, Love, and Bitcoin, Paul Rogers. Paul, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Scott. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on here. And I really look forward to our discussion because I think both you and your audience are primed to really be able to go much deeper than a lot of other conversations in the Bitcoin space go because of your work in writing The Tao of Bitcoin, which I didn't discover until after I had finished mine. And I'm like, oh, yes, he gets it. And so, you know, I think we see there's so much more to the opportunity here in Bitcoin, and then it's much deeper and profound than most of us imagined when we first fell down the rabbit hole. But as we go deeper beyond much of the very relevant and important signal that's going on in this space about, you know, what's happening with the number and the Fed and the yen carry trade and things like that. But that doesn't touch a lot of people's hearts. It doesn't deal with the much more profound matters that I think are going to get us from that phrase of fix the money to fix the world. My view is there's space in between those phrases. And yes, we have to fix the money. And that's going to give us a new foundation to build new systems and structures for to conserve all of humanity. But it's going to take some deeper thought to get us. It's going to take an awful lot to even fix the money, as we well know. But it's going to take even more to then begin to really lay the foundations for the universal principles, which are really going to lead us to new systems and structures for a new digital age.
I actually don't honestly know if I could have said any of that better myself. That was beautifully put. We do have a lot in common. I've been looking forward to this conversation, and we have been talking for some time. I was fortunate to have the opportunity to read your book beforehand. And, you know, honestly, it's one of these things. This happened for me too. Afterwards, you know, you find things. I'd written my book, and then people start messaging me like, oh, have you read this? Have you read that? And I'm almost worried about, you know, like accusations of plagiarism, or it's not that, it's just because we're on a similar intellectual current. And I personally believe that, you know, nobody has ideas. We receive ideas as a result of sort of paying attention and being in tune with a larger, you know, the process that's unfolding. And so, yeah, I think your book is brilliant. I loved it. And it reminds me of a conversation I had about a year ago with Tomer Strohlite. And we called that episode Bitcoin is Synchronizing Human Consciousness. And it was this broader idea that Bitcoin is sort of like an intellectual black hole is not the right word, but it's a good analogy because it does sort of suck people in and force us to start thinking about things in the same way. And I think that's probably something that's going on here. Something else I thought was interesting as I was reading your book and as we've been chatting is we also share this background of experience in traditional financial services. And that was sort of the origin point of thinking about how to communicate Bitcoin ideas to a broader audience. So I would love to just actually start there, chatting a little bit about your own experience. You were a financial advisor, a financial planner, and found Bitcoin. Maybe just walk us through that journey and how your experiences in that world prepared you to help talk about Bitcoin with everyone else.
Sure. Well, my most recent career before falling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole was as a certified financial planner, an investment manager. And unlike a lot of people in the space who show up on a lot of these podcasts, I wasn't in the trading rooms. I wasn't in a hedge fund. I wasn't investing capital for others. I was working with regular people, all right, who were trying to save for retirement, who were trying to manage their funds in retirement so that they didn't run out of money before they ran out of life. So my interaction in the TradFi space was really bringing together the understanding and the challenges that we had in communicating basic investment principles with everyday people living their life and recognizing how little many people understood about money. How, as I talk about in the book, most people don't really want to invest money. They don't want to take on the risk associated with that. They're not interested in being venture capitalists trying to parlay their retirement savings into a fleet of Lamborghinis. They just want to live their life. And they've generally done the right thing by saving and not consuming as much as they earn. They wanted to be able to secure it in a way that would secure their future for their families. And what I didn't realize until I got out of that business and I got into Bitcoin was one of the fundamental reasons why that is just so darn difficult. And that is the nature of our inflationary system itself, which robs people of the ability to do what they really want to do, which is simply save their excess funds from what they've earned and not have that depleted and stolen from them by those who are extracting wealth and robbing them through inflation. So because my perspective was really that intersection of traditional finance with, you know, real world people, if you will, regular people, you know, I realized over time and my practice evolved. And at the end of my practice, I had gone independent and rebranded my business as Mindful Wealth Management because I wanted to see people be more mindful than just getting caught up in what's happening on CNBC and the chatter talk and, you know, Jim Cramer, Booyah, and all that stuff, that it was about what the money was going to do for them in their life. And to get off the insanity of following the market from day to day or month to month and the inevitable variations that it's going to have and think about what they really wanted to do in their lives. I also became a retirement coach because I saw a lot of people who, after working their whole lives, really hadn't given much thought to understanding what they wanted to do in the future and to have a clear vision for what this money was supposed to do for them to live their lives. I think it relates a little bit to a section in the book that I talk about that I think in the Bitcoin space, you know, a lot of us view, and it's absolutely true, that we want freedom. And then we see Bitcoin as freedom from a lot of control structures, regulatory environments, the limitations of the existing system. Just as my clients wanted the freedom from having to work to then be able to go and do something else in their life, but oftentimes they weren't clear what that really was going to be other than not having to work. And I think that also occurs a little bit in the Bitcoin space, at least in the dialogue, because I think it's just as important about what Bitcoin is freedom from as what Bitcoin is freedom to do. And that's the bigger question, you know, that you probe in your book, that I probe in mine, is, you know, life is not going to be solved by numbers in a bank account or on your hardware wallet. The issues that really touch us all in our lives, why we're here, what we want to do, how we want to experience love and connection with other people, aren't going to be answered by money, though it is going to be a sounder foundation if we have a sound money to be able to then to launch into the more deeper dialogue of, okay, now that I have a certain degree of freedom from these things, what's that freedom to do? And I think that's where both you and I and many others can add a real value in this space by seeing beyond the immediate of how Bitcoin adoption is going to go to where, again, are we going to go from fixing the money to fixing the world?
So we've talked maybe around the premise of your book, but maybe just to if we could lay it out, you know, how do you view Bitcoin as how should people be thinking about Bitcoin? And what is the general premise of Money, Love, and Bitcoin?
So, you know, there's three words in the title of my book, and most people can get, even if you don't understand what Bitcoin is or you dismiss it, that money and Bitcoin have something to do with each other. But there's this word in the middle, love, which seems very out of place. And it's not about loving money, because there's lots of books that have been written about that. And there's lots of dialogue about people loving Bitcoin. But I mean real love. And I think that's the universal principle that I'm trying to connect here. And so the premise of the book is, yes, we have to understand in a simple way what the problem is with the existing system. And, you know, there's lots of great books that have been written about that. There's people have far more expertise than I do in that space that have written great things. But oftentimes, with lots of charts and graphs and lots of economic history and details, they're not going to land on the average person. Right? They're, you know, it's tough enough to get a lot of people to spend much time trying to understand and wrap their heads around what is money, moreover reading economic textbooks. And so I keep it and start it up very simply. And I'd say, you know, we have to understand that money is simply a technology. It's a technology for accounting for and transacting and storing the value of the work that we do. And that's the fundamental point. It's the contribution of value that all of us do, which is what creates the need for money at all. So without adding value, money is meaningless. The problem we have in our existing system is that not everybody's always contributing value. We have lots of people and lots of systems and structures that are extracting value, whether it's through an inflationary system, whether it's early access to a money printer, whether it's creating money out of nothing instead of actually a contribution of real value, whether it's, frankly, trading activities or, you know, hedging foreign currency transactions. That's a necessary thing in a fiat structure, but it really adds no value to humanity. It's just necessary. And a lot of people can make a lot of money at it. And so people are drawn oftentimes to extractive behaviors rather than contributing value. And we've got to understand this is where money starts. So once we do that, we have to recognize this is going to be there forever. We all need to contribute something to humanity, to ourselves, to our families. And what I'd hope is that we can get to a point where, as Jeff Booth is, I think, the best articulator, this prices fall to the marginal cost of production because we're not in this inflationary system and technology improvements make things cheaper, that more people are going to have the opportunity to really express their own gifts and talents, to not have to do a job just to pay the bills, but ultimately to be able to really contribute the value that rises up from each unique human being. And so, you know, the Bitcoin platform opportunity, I think, provides a monetary structure that we all believe is a far better technology of money for being able to stop these extractive forces and give us that opportunity. But we do need to think about what it is that we are going to be doing when we get to this stage. What is it that each of us want to do in our lives? Because we've gotten to a point in our cultures and our societies where we have been consumed by a monetary and a commercial structure where nearly everything in life is being viewed through this lens of commercial transactions. And a free market for commercial transactions is much better than the other systems that have been tried. And hopefully, we will get to a freer market so that more people, when they share their gifts and talents and others see them as valuable, will have that contribution honored and respected and their labor not stolen from them and their time and energy. But not everything in life is a transaction. That's the base layer. Whether it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs or from a philosophical, religious, or spiritual tradition, you know, meeting the basic needs of life of food, shelter, and clothing is the foundation. It's sad that in our world today, with the abundance that we do have, with the technology we have, with the resources of this planet, that we have not been able to figure out systems and structures to allow more people to at least meet their baseline needs. It's not a call for equality and egalitarianism that everyone is equal. Absolutely not. We all come to this planet with different gifts and talents. We all express them in different ways. We all have raised in different environments with different opportunities. And we contribute what we can. But again, there's much more to life than a commercial transaction. So I've had discussions, and you probably have had too, where people talk about all relations are transactional. And we've got to see that through that lens to understand what's going on. And I reflect on that, and I think I understand where that viewpoint comes from. I see that exercised in lots of relationships and lots of dialogue that goes on. But you know, if your relations are built as transactions, for example, I don't think you're going to have a very good marriage. I don't think you raise children because there's some sort of a transaction looking for them to pay off in the future for you. I don't think that's the way we build community, that we really interact with others. So when this commercial transaction mindset seeps into everything we do, and it seeps in because of a debt and credit system that often gives us this very high time preference and short-term orientation rather than thinking for the long term. But it got me, what prompted it in many ways was realizing, you know, there's people that raise these issues. Safedine raised it in, you know, in the fiat stand, in the Bitcoin standard. And I first read it, I'm like, what the heck is he bringing all this stuff into it? I don't get it. And then over time, you begin to get it. And you realize, you know what? I was actually on the mat one day doing yoga. I'm a yoga practitioner, and yoga in a way that's not an exercise class, you know, that you do at the gym, but yoga is a deep philosophy. And I said, you know what? We need to bring something into this space that I don't hear as much talk about. And that's what I think connects us all. And that's love. And that's why that's the middle word of my book.
Hey, everyone. Quick question. Have you ever thought about starting a video podcast like this one? I want to introduce you to the team behind my show, Podigy. This podcast has been one of the best marketing tools for our business. And thanks to Podigy, all I have to do is hit record. They handle everything else, editing, writing, publishing, and making sure that it's perfectly optimized for every platform. They only work with disruptors, mavericks, and change makers, people making a real difference, spreading big ideas. Typically, Podigy is fully booked, but right now they have a few spots open for new clients. Listeners of this show get 10% off launching their own podcast or optimizing their current one. Click the link in the bio for a free one-on-one podcast planning session with Podigy. If you are thinking about starting a podcast or you have one and you want to take it to the next level, I can't recommend Podigy enough. Check them out. Yeah, I'm actually finding myself so enjoying just listening to you talk. A few things, you know, as I was listening to you, I was thinking about, you mentioned FX trades specifically, and I think it's such a great example. There are so many activities that happen in the economics of a fiat currency world that, in Jeff's words, require the price of everything to go up forever so that the entire system doesn't collapse. And those same rules that happen at a sort of a global level do absolutely apply to individual people and create in the day-to-day a lot of stuff that really is actions and behaviors and needs that are fiat driven. And that's not a criticism of anybody who is trapped in or benefiting from those systems. This is just kind of the way it is. How we get to a different looking system, I agree with you, is it's a fascinating thing to think about. And I wanted to maybe come back to something you said much earlier in the conversation about universal law. And this is something that I don't know if I've necessarily had a chance to really talk about on the show. And you do a really great job talking about in the book. So let's go there next.
Sure. So, you know, I think whatever you want to call it, universal law, principles, spiritual principles, there are certain things that go beyond the mundane, that go beyond even a scientific viewpoint of a Newtonian world of classical interaction of matter. And those things absolutely happen. And yet, as quantum physics has shown us, and you know, your book is The Tao of Bitcoin, and I mentioned in my book, one of the seminal works that influenced me was a book written in the late 70s by Fritjof Capra, The Tao of Physics.
One of my favorite books.
It's a very profound thing. It influenced me tremendously.
Actually, just to interrupt you for a second, that was one of the books that when I published my book, people had assumed I had read, and I actually hadn't. And now I'm working on a second edition that respects and integrates some of his brilliant work. So sorry, that's a little sidebar there, but yeah.
Yeah, no. Well, and then when you read that, then you got to go read the systems view of life, which is the modern science of all the systems of biology and ecology, et cetera. But at any event, you know, what I think you show in your book and what that shows is there are things going on in the world that don't meet the tests of just the perception of our normal five senses. They're not necessarily things we can see and hear and smell and taste. You know, we perceive objects as physical solid matter. And we do that as beings in this world to get along. And it's helpful. It's just the way we perceive things. And yet, quantum physics shows us, and particle physics shows us that, you know, it's all energy. It's an arrangement of matter, its frequencies, its vibrations. And so if we go a little deeper and understand that there are, that energy connects us all, you know, that law of thermodynamics, that energy can neither be created or nor destroyed, just transformed or altered or changed. You know, if everything is energy, we begin to think about, okay, everything is a frequency, a vibration that we are experiencing through our own unique receiver. So in the book, for example, I use that analogy of a radio, and I think it's helpful. So, you know, if we are receivers, and we are receivers of signals that we are getting all the time, and we tune into some signals and we tune out other signals. So if, for example, the only signal we tune into is AM radio, we're going to just perceive whatever is being projected to us at that frequency. And AM radio has its wonderful programs and broadcasts and music, and it's of a limited frequency. You know, it's oftentimes very contentious talk radio, lots of angry people yelling at each other. It's very different than listening to a Brahms symphony on an FM radio. And so what we tune into has a lot to do with how we process all these frequencies out there, and then how we reflect and act in the course of our lives. So, you know, we're bombarded with 24/7 media of polarized politics, great confusion in economics and finance, great dissension in the world, implications in the military-industrial complex that keep us having at war. Yet behind all that is something that connects us all, is this energy. And so we have to realize that we live in a system. We are not unique and discrete entities. We are unique entities, but we are not discrete entities. We are part of a larger system. And so when we think about how we are going to construct new systems based on new technology for a new digital age, again, which moves us from this analog physical age to cyberspace, where you can't see anything. We can't touch it. We can't feel it. We can't smell it. Money exists there. All the data exists there. All my information is in the cloud. that begins us to get a little closer to the reality that, yeah, everything is out there. And just as you said earlier, you know, there are times, I think, in history where ideas percolate and they come up. And so there aren't necessarily unique ideas. There may be unique interpretations in them or receptions of them. And certain times in history, you know, it's interesting. How did in America, for example, you have all these brilliant founding fathers catching these same signals and waves and frequencies to create a new system and structure for mankind? How did at certain times in history, we have great spiritual masters seem to rise up all of a sudden at the same time, bringing forth great degrees of wisdom? It's because we're catching different frequencies at different times, because our receivers, and this may be like, what are these people talking about? But our receivers are able to tune into higher frequencies. So these are the universal laws and principles and that we can tap into, but they don't have to be this abstract or confusing. Let's look at that middle word of my book, love. So go do a science experiment to prove what love is, how it exists, and what the conditions are under which it is created and maintained. Good luck. Not aware of any science experiment that has done that or that ever could. And we all know that, you know? We're not going to get there through those mechanisms. Yet, hopefully, most of us all know what love is, have experienced it, and recognize that it's the most important thing in life. If you had to choose between a Lambo, and there's nothing wrong with having a Lambo, but if you had to choose, you get a Lambo or you have love, what are you going to choose?
Doesn't seem like a close choice to me, but I don't have a Lambo.
And everybody knows that. Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing that everybody knows. So if the more we begin to weave all these elements of our monetary and economic system, our social structures, our educational systems, our relational dynamics between each other into some of these deeper principles, not only is that how we're going to create better systems and structures, which are going to serve all of humanity rather than attempt to exploit certain people for other people's benefit, but we're also going to be able, I think, to demonstrate why these new systems and structures built on a Bitcoin standard are really what we need to propel humanity forward and are going to be beneficial for everybody. If we're perceived in the Bitcoin community through the lens of many of the actors that have been out there, you know, exercise fiat behavior and the crypto bros with their scam coins and the FTX collapses and all of these scams, then we're not going to touch people as quickly or as deeply with why this is so important. Everybody knows something is wrong. I think that's why we had these rise of, you know, populism on right and the left. There's this undercurrent that's something is broken in this system. And of course, all the politicians are pointing to things which are not the real reasons. And we know that the monetary system is a large part of it. But it's had so much influence on our psychology, on our behaviors, on our mindsets, on our cosmology, our, for lack of a better term, our spirituality, because we've discarded that in favor of pure scientific rationality alone and commercialism. And that's not the end of life. That's not all there is.
I live in Canada, and we are in the middle of a federal election right now. And it's the same thing that happened in the U.S. last year, where whoever is running for any office will talk about everything except the problem of money. And so, you know, again, you can't begrudge anyone for the scope of this problem, elude them. It's by design. And we are intentionally, you know, have our focus pointed elsewhere to obscure the enormity of the heist that's going on globally. Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, to echo some of your comments there about the system and the idea that whether, and this is something that Kafka talks about in the Tao of Physics, where, you know, it's this, you don't necessarily need to agree with something. It's a process that's unfolding and embedded into the cellular nature, you know, at a cellular level of everything that's happening everywhere. So these are just the way that the procedural nature of like physical reality works. And yeah, I think that I talk about this in my book as well, the idea that the way money works right now, because of its extractive nature, it actually does sort of defy this second law of thermodynamics about creating energy out of thin air. And so we are kind of continually trying to make sense of the world with an economic set of rules that doesn't follow the rules of how things actually work. And that's just a very impossible thing to reconcile.
It's a hard thing to wrap your mind around with when you've only grown up, all of us, and our parents and our grandparents, in a system. We're inside this box where money is something that is created and controlled by governments. Experts are managing the economy. That's just the way it is. I mean, you know, again, being in traditional finance, I spent 20 years going to meetings with all these talking heads, pontificating about, you know, what was happening in the markets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all this minutiae and details and inside baseball and charts and graphs. And it creates a lot of jobs and a lot of careers for people. They sound really smart, but let's back to the basics. And if we can, I like to think it as, you know, the idea of thinking about money as not something created or controlled by the government bends everybody's frame a little bit, because, you know, we've got a frame that's composed of a fiat currency in the middle of it with a picture of a dead president or a king or a queen or whatever it is. And that's what money is. We got to bend that frame and jar it a little bit. But again, it's really, if we peel it back from lots of fancy economic jargon and say, if money is just a technology to account for and transact and store value between the creators of value, you and me, growing potatoes, digging iron out of the ground and melting it into steel and building buildings, creating art, creating music, exercising the healing arts, whatever it is, how can a government and a central bank simply create money by adding digits to an account or running printing presses? That makes no sense. Just because that's what's been happening doesn't mean it makes sense. And, you know, I try to relay that in a way that without lots of discussion about M2 money supply, you know, I hope that we can communicate why the system doesn't make any sense. So we can bend some frames and we can look outside this limited box, despite all the people wanting to keep us inside this box for their power and their control, even though we all know something's wrong and broken.
Yeah. I mean, and then too, I guess by extension, it's this idea of imagining what would a world look like where a technological innovation has really, you know, sort of solved this problem from the bottom up and enabled people to think about spending their time in differently and storing their energy differently. And yeah, it's an exciting thing to think about.
Yeah, no, it is. And I think, you know, I get into dialogues with people and I begin to explain some of these things about the system. And it at first, it sounds kind of depressing. And I'm like, oh, you're a real downer. I'm like, no, I have never been more optimistic of seeing a way forward for humanity that can benefit all of us to go to places that we've never been able to go. And I don't just mean Mars. I mean, going to places in our states of consciousness, our states of understanding, the ability of much more of humanity to be able to probe and experience what's their place in life, what's meaningful to them. And I don't think anybody has the answers to those questions. I certainly am not going to suggest that there is an answer which I choose to foist on other people. It's part of the journey and the exploration. And I think that's critically important. And others who want to foist one answer on people from any one tradition or any one philosophy or approach, you know, can sometimes be a little scary. So, but it's the journey. It's the ability to have the luxury of the time and resources and ability. And we see this in all these videos of these moms behind the wheel of their car in tears with the kids screaming in the back saying, I'm going to my third job. I'm just trying to make ends meet. I'm trying to take care of my family. I can't pay my rent. And it's a travesty. And it's so sad. And it doesn't have to be this way. And those are the people that we all need to touch because it's all of us. It affects all of us. And so if we can begin to craft a new way forward, and this is why I think this dialogue is so much more important, because, you know, and I saw this with my clients, their eyes would glaze over after about the third chart I threw up on the screen to show them about economic data and their portfolio, which I was going to demonstrate some things to them. And I certainly had real valid information to show them, but the eyes glaze over because it just doesn't mean much. And you know what? It shouldn't have to, okay? You know, the mom driving her car to her second job should not have to be a PhD economist to figure out how to live life and to feed her family and to express her love and to do what she wants and to be able to have time in nature. There's no reason for that, but we've created a system that's just insane. And so, you know, what it's going to look like if we're able to strip out some of that extractive behavior, what once we have the freedom from, what it's going to be the freedom to do, is exactly the type of thing that I think we have the opportunity to have a lot more dialogue on, because certain systems are going to dissolve and be unnecessary, but we're still going to have social and organizational structures and institutions. And we can either replace them with more centralized, more control structures, CBDCs, et cetera. All right, no matter what our base layer of money is, they're going to have some real impacts and consequences for humanity, or we can begin to create a new vision. And I don't know what it looks like, but I do know that we need to have more dialogue about this because we've never been there as humanity. This is new for us, okay? We've never had a digital age. We haven't lived in cyberspace. We haven't had our money in cyberspace. We haven't had all of our data there. We haven't had the ability to tap in to the degree of abundance of energy that exists on this planet in ways and to transmit it between people, where access to information is no longer limited to a few chosen people in certain academic or religious structures. We can all have access to that information. But we can also be, and I talk about this in the book, you know, information and data, there are so abundant and getting to the point of being so meaningless. You know, we are at a stage where you can prove anything with enough data. But data is not knowledge. And knowledge is not wisdom either. So we need to move towards more wisdom so that we can exercise our technology in ways that respect the universal laws and principles and interconnection between all of us, and think about and have dialogues about what that might look like and where are we going outside the guardrails. And, you know, I think in, I talk about this in the book also, I think that cultures and societies for many years, for all of time, for the most part, have had certain guardrails in ways of looking at the world, oftentimes historically through mythologies. So I talk about Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey and the mythologies there. And we look at those in modern times going, these crazy stories about these gods and thunderbolts and this and that and going up mountains and pushing rocks. It seems crazy. And they are as stories, but they were a way of transferring deeper universal wisdom to people and providing guardrails. And in the very wise pursuit of a scientific rational framework to interact with the material world, we've also thrown out these wisdom traditions, which provided some guardrails and some ways of processing how we are moving through life within our capacity to do new things with the material world. And so by probing the Tao, by probing these ancient wisdom traditions, we can see, are we moving more in harmony? Are we moving more towards balance? Are we becoming more out of balance and inconsistent? And it's harder to do that when we don't have broader cultural frameworks that for most of history we had, for better or worse at different times in different cultures. But we'll need some new ones for a new age.
Yeah, it makes me think of Svetsky's book, Bushido of Bitcoin. I'm not sure if you've read it yet. And he may turn out to be right, but that book is really an exploration of this notion that Bitcoiners are the early formation of an entirely new social class. People who sort of head out into the world having understood this change and have the new operating system of how to think about imagining new systems for a society that really works fundamentally differently. And at the base layer, it's the idea of exchanging credit versus a final settlement that happens every single time we pass this thing back and forth. And it's like a ripple in a pond to me.
Yes. And I think it is true that we are going to need leaders. We are going to need thought leaders that operate and can probe and explore what is going on in the intersection of all these events to begin to frame out and think about and debate and dialogue about how we're going to build these new systems and institutions and structures and on what principles. And I've not read the full Bushido. I've read parts of it and I've seen some of his interviews. And I think, again, he's talking about some deep principles there of integrity and honor. And I just throw in this one that I don't think there's any human being on earth is going to walk away from this principle and say, that's probably a pretty good foundational principle on which we should craft systems. And that's love. Love for ourselves, love for others, love for every being and planet, sentient or not, on this earth and in this universe. You know, it doesn't always show up that way. So it might seem, oh, what is this kumbaya stuff? You know, no, okay. But, you know, if we operate on that framework, we're probably going to build some pretty damn good systems.
Couldn't agree more. I, you know, in writing my book, I was searching for a way to talk about the movie Interstellar, which is, I say, it's one of my favorite movies. It might be my favorite movie. And, you know, it's a sci-fi, it's a space adventure, it's all these things. It's a movie about quantum mechanics and time, but it's a movie about love. And like ultimately, it's a movie that helps sort of explain ideas about how quantum mechanics works as principally, you know, showing someone's behavior driven by love. And which for me is just, yeah, as I listen, I think it's just, It's a great way to visualize in a fun way some of these principles. And Paul, I could do this all day. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, and I know we're going to do it again. Obviously, we're going to include some links to the book, but is there anywhere you'd like to point people who are listening specifically so that they could find more of you?
Sure. Well, the website for the book is www.moneyloveandbitcoin.com. All the social media links are on there. I'm fairly active on X, so that's probably the best platform to interact with me. And I hope everybody considers picking up a copy, reading it, and joining the discussion and the dialogue about how we are going to create a path to a freer, fairer, and more peaceful world. And I really appreciate the time and the dialogue, Scott.
I recommend it highly for anyone who's listening. And if you are listening and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in, and hope to see you again next week.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. BlockRewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.